downstairs who wasn't at the meeting, he said, "What was the meeting about?" And I said, "Alcoholic insanity." He said, "What'd they all talk about?" And I said, "They all talked about the crazy stuff you and I would do under the influence when we were drunk." He said, "Well, let's sit down and talk about that for a second." We sat down. He said, "Why don't you make a list of the 10 craziest things you ever did? And if those of you in the room that are new, you can think of five or so of the most insane things you ever did." I wrote them down. Armed robbery, drunk. Stuck a gun in someone's face, drunk. Blah, 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 blah. Every one of them was under the influence. This guy shook his head and he said, "I'll bet you $10,000 the most insane thing you ever did, number one on the hit parade, number one, the most insane thing you ever did was with nothing in your system, bone dry, further away from your last drink than you did for me that night. And what needs to happen in this part of the first step, you need to be pulled out from behind the bottle to clearly see what happens when you don't have it in your system at all. Because what he helped me see is the most insane thing that this guy has ever done is to pick up the first drink. And I did that 28 days out of the Michigan State Penitentiary at my very best, further away from my last drink than I'd been in a long time. Because I never had had 28 days for a long time. And I commit alcoholic insanity at my very best. At my very best, I pick up the first drink. See, the ego takes the very best of you and uses it against you. One more thing before we cover these pages I'd like to mention, and that is, and this is sometimes hard for me to explain, but I can tell you, when I got free of this, it lifted 1,000 pounds off my back, because so far we've been confronted with two questions. I'm going to go over this again when we're at the other end of the work, and the question is, why do you think God's working in your life? But the questions we've covered so far is, Joe, how come you always drink so much once you start? And how come you always start again every time you stop and make up your mind never to do it again? Why do you always start again? One's about the body, one's about the mind. When asked those questions, what my ego likes to do is say, because of what's going on out here, or because of how I'm feeling. So let's break that down. Why do you drink so much once you start to drink? Well, because she left me. Well, don't you get the craving when she stays? Well, because the team lost. Well, don't you get that craving when the team wins? Well, because I'm on Skid Row, I get the craving. Well, didn't you used to get the craving when you were in the penthouse in Las Vegas? Well, I get the craving because it's sunny. Well, don't you get the craving when it's cloudy? And all of a sudden, they pull everything out from under me that I think is the reason out here for why I get the craving in here. Then my ego will go, okay, it doesn't have to do with circumstance, outward circumstance. It has to do with my low self-esteem and how I'm feeling.
What Susie talked about yesterday. Right.
I just need to like myself a little bit more. Well, didn't you get the craving when you liked yourself a whole lot? Yeah. Guy comes up to me one time in West Hollywood out where I live, and he says, you know, Moore has been, he was going to use the book on me. He obviously didn't know who he was talking to, but he was going to try to use the book, and he was going to say, we in the 90s have realized that alcoholism isn't a physical, mental, and spiritual disease that no human power can relieve. I said, oh, what if, I wanted to ask him who the hell we were, but I was more interested in what they had found. I said, oh, what have we found in the 90s? You know, probably one of these guys that works in one of these places. He said, well, we in the 90s that have found... He said, we in the 90s have found out that alcoholism isn't physical, mental. It's not a threefold disease that no human power can relieve. I said, what have we found out? He said, it's a feeling disease based in shame. And you can ask these guys that have been around a lot longer than we have. About every 2 or 3 years, there's new buzzwords. And one of the current buzzwords is shame. It's a shame-based disease, right? And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Because remember I told you I come from a group where we're allowed... I know about asking questions because I also sit in my living room a lot with drunks and I ask questions. I said, let me ask you a question. Did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to, when you were feeling really bad and you were full of shame? He says, yeah, see? And then I knew the game was over. I had him. We were done playing, but he didn't know it yet. I had to show him we were done. And I said, well, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to, when you were feeling really great and there was no shame at all and you were king of the mountain? He said, yeah. I said, well, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to, when you weren't feeling much at all? He said, yeah. I said, did you ever drink again just to feel something? He said, yeah. I said, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to not feel anything? He said, yeah. I said, then what the hell does alcohol care about how you feel, whether you drink it again or not? And somewhere in this process, I have to get free that circumstance and my emotional state have nothing to do with why the craving and the obsession happened. Because doing good or doing bad, in the penthouse or on Skid Row or in between, not doing much at all, when she stays, when she leaves, when she goes, when she's here, when she's not here, when the team wins or loses or draws or ties, when it's sunny or cloudy or rainy or foggy, I get a physical craving for booze beyond my emotional state and the circumstances in my life. And the obsession happens the same way too. Okay.
Give me an example. Just yesterday, we were at a meeting. And a gentleman was sharing in the meeting. He'd gotten some bad news the night before. And here's what he says. This is the trap of this. He says, you know, I knew I should have come down to a meeting and talked about this problem. He said, I knew I should have, but I didn't. He said, next time I will. And so I'm sitting there and I'm saying to myself, because here's my experience. I think probably I'm in far graver danger when I'm sitting on top of the world and everything's going my way than when I have a problem, because I'm such a weenie. When I have a problem, I turn a lot more to God. You see, I had to get rid of this idea that I'm supposed to go into meetings or call a sponsor or pray when things turn and don't go out the way. Because I'm real clear on something today based on my experience. I don't have a clue what the day looks like when I'm going to pick up a drink again. So I don't go to meetings or I don't work the steps or I don't do this stuff based on how I feel or based on the external circumstances of my life. Because I drink when it's going great and I drink when it's going terrible. You see what I'm saying? And I had to get free of this idea. I had to get free of drinking has anything to do with whether I'm feeling good or whether I'm feeling bad. It's just me and booze calls to me, and this obsession comes back again.
Page 23, middle of the third paragraph, but in my heart I really don't know why I do it. Bottom of the page, the tragic truth is if I be a real alcoholic, the happy day where I will be able to assert my power of will may not arrive. I have lost control. Now, two very important paragraphs. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, I pass into the state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Choice, need, want, desire, what's needed, necessary, or right, don't enter into the picture when it comes to me and drinking again. Especially choice, desire, and will. If I can, with choice, desire, or will, keep myself from drinking again, I am not powerless over alcohol. Therefore, I am powerless over alcohol because I can't choose, or my desire or what I want isn't strong enough. Next paragraph. The fact is, most alcoholics, for reasons that we don't understand, have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Let me say that again. We have lost the power of choice. Our willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness the suffering with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. I can't keep myself sober on my own power. The consequences that would follow taking even one beer don't crowd into my mind to stop me. If these thoughts occur, if I start to think it through, I told you, every question that we looked at last night on that page of myth questions was going to be answered by the book. Would thinking it through or remembering the pain be enough at a certain time? These two paragraphs have just told me that the pain of the memory of the pain and humiliation would not be enough, and even if I think it through, these thoughts won't be able to stop me.
How many in this room have sat in a meeting and said, think through the drink, or heard think through the drink? Well,
how many of you in the room that just raised your hand are the kind of people, if you thought it through very far, would just say, screw it anyway, right?
So you can see what the book says. It uses the word, it says, if these thoughts occurred. The word if is, means condition. They're implying these thoughts may not come up, and it says they're hazy, meaning these thoughts. Book is going to talk a lot about, in the 11th step, it uses something called thought life. It's going to talk a lot about thinking. It's going to tell us things like, if I'm willing to submit to this process, that there will be a revolutionary change in the way I think and the way I live. But let's go on with this. If these thoughts occur, these thoughts are hazy. They're readily supplemented with the old threadbare idea, this time I'll handle myself like other people, control my drinking. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps me from putting my hand in a hot stove. Let me give you another example. How many of you have been burned on a stove? Raise your hands. Well, let me ask you this. If you walked into a friend's house and they had a gas range and burner was on high, would you walk up and put your hand on the stove? No. You know why? Because you got burned one time. You have a mental defense from now till the day you die. You will never do that. But I want you to think of something. I want you to pretend that that gas range is you and booze. Here's what I did. I burned myself on it. They sent me to the hospital. I came home, my hands swathed in bandages. I walk in the house. The burner's on, and I look at it, and I say, you know what? I kind of like just the initial start of that thing. I think I'm going to do this again. And I put it on there. Pretty soon, this arm's gone. This arm's gone. My legs are gone. I'm asking you to set me on the damn stove because I have no mental defense. It took me about 10 years sobriety to understand this stupid little sentence. Mark, you have it. When I was about 5 years old, I pulled a kettle full of steaming hot water on me and just scalded me half to death. If a teapot even goes off, I jump about 3 feet in the air. And it took me about 10 years to understand the stupid little example they're giving me to look at my own experience that, Mark, there's going to come a day when you'll have no effective mental defense over the first drink, and anything that's happened to you as a result of drinking is going to be totally unavailable to you. You're going to go stick your damn hand in that burner again.
Then here's the scariest day. In the third paragraph that starts off, the alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Then here's the scariest one of all. Or perhaps you don't think at all. How often have some of us began to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or fourth drink pounded on the bar, said to ourselves, how did I ever get started again? Bottom of the page. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. You'll find the next page begins to talk about the solution, and at the bottom, it's going to come back to these two ideas. At the bottom, it sums it up. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, there is no middle-of-the-road solution. You're in a position where life is becoming impossible. So how do you know when you're hearing in meetings or from a sponsor or from a speaker? How do you know when you're hearing middle-of-the-road solution? Well, in the middle paragraph that starts off, the great fact is just this and nothing less. We have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. That's the solution. So if you're hearing somebody who's telling you how they came to need or came to have or what they did after they had a vital spiritual experience, you're not hearing middle-of-the-road solution. But if you're hearing people talk about anything but how they came to need, how they came to have, and what they did after they had a deep and effective spiritual experience, if you're hearing anything other than that as the solution for you to your alcoholism, you're hearing middle-of-the-road solution. Because it's going to say here at the bottom of this paragraph, if you're alcoholic as serious as we are, and there's no return through human aid, you just have two alternatives. One is to go on the best you can, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation as best you can. The other is to accept spiritual help. They'll come back to these two alternatives again when we're done with this part of the first step.
But, and it goes on to say, this we did because we honestly wanted to or willing to make the effort. Highlight willing to make the effort. I'm sitting in a meeting on willingness the other day, and let me tell you my truth about willingness. My willingness is as deep as my actions. I'm not concerned. When I'm working with an alcoholic, I'm not concerned with their intent. I'm not concerned with the words that come rumbling out of their mouth. I'm very concerned about the action they're taking. Okay? A lot of people are willing. A lot of people honestly want to. A lot are unwilling to make the effort. And my experience confirms it's all because they haven't looked at their experience and found out the truth in step one. I had a flamethrower up my ass once I found out my truth in step one. There, you see, what is the fellowship full of? It's full of human beings. You can't keep me sober. You can't keep me sober. I can't keep me sober. I had to find God based on my truth. But there's a part of me that wants to shield the truth from me. The gift that was given to Joe and I in terms of breaking down step one is it peeled away all that stuff, and I'm standing there naked saying, you know what? I mean, when I was 3 years sober and saw this the first time, let alone when I just looked at it again in April, it fills me with the wonder and awe of this power, because I'm sitting here this morning not drunk from alcohol because of God's love for me, and all I had to do is be willing to seek him and take the action. I'm not sitting here sober this morning because of what I know, because of any other reason. All that stuff got peeled away. And I don't know about the rest of you, but that sure keeps me in a state of humility. I mean, I get up this morning. I'm 49 years old this morning. I should have been dead a long, long time ago. And I said, thank you, God. Thank you, God, that I'm sucking air this morning and that I'm sober. And it hasn't got anything to do with anything I've ever done other than what the book says is, Mark, are you willing to seek the power? None of us in this room will seek the power unless you have an experience and find out your truth in step one. I don't care how long you've been sober. Another trap for people been sober for a while is their ego starts to convince them they're doing things to keep themselves sober, and then slowly they stop doing things. Pretty soon they don't have a home group. Pretty soon they're not working with other people. Pretty soon it's been a long time since they did any work with the steps. I wonder how close they are to a drink of alcohol and they don't even know it. I have men and women around me today who I'm accountable to. As I told you, love me more as a child of God and they care about how I feel, and they ask me some real direct serious questions. They hurt my feelings with some consistency. Can you imagine?
Today's Mark's 49th birthday. Happy birthday.
All right. Now.
On 26 and 27, I hate that flamethrower comment because just the picture of it makes me cringe. On 26 and 27, you'll find the guy Roland Hazard, who goes to Dr. Carl Jung, who's considered the father of modern-day psychology. And he asked Dr. Carl Jung about what's wrong with his mind. Why does he keep returning to alcohol after being separated from it? We found the guy who went to Dr. Silkworth to find out about why does his body crave more once he starts. Now we're going to find the explanation. This is the other doctor that gave us the second half of the first half of step one. We're still on the first half of step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. We've looked at the body. Now we're looking at the mind. And the doctor tells him, Roland believed that above all he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. He thought he could prevent his next relapse. He thought relapse prevention was possible. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall, so he returned to the doctor who he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society and would have to place himself under lock and key. On the next page, you'll see that he asked the doctor, are there any exceptions to this? Because above that, the doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and I've never seen one single case recover where the state of mind exists to the extent that it does in you. So we're looking at a state of mind here, not body. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, are there no exceptions? The doctor replied, yes, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early time. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. Then he describes how this thing is going to feel for us, for you and I. These occur to be phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Here's how it's going to feel in your life. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding force in your life, are going to be suddenly cast aside for a completely new set of conceptions and motives which will begin to dominate you. That's the explanation he got from Carl Jung.
Page 28. We, in our own turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. That's a little bit of a paradox to what I hear in meetings of take your time. Think about that. It's kind of like telling a hopeless alcoholic, and in their first week or they come to a meeting, they're sitting there, and they're dying of alcoholism, and we tell them to take their time. Or we tell them this, we tell them keep coming back. See, there are some people coming to meetings of AA who think they can. The book says seek recovery with the desperation of a drowning man. I owe that new man or woman the dignity to sit down with them right then and open this book and talk to them about the hopelessness of alcoholism because they may never make it back. I don't tell them keep coming back. I can't find that anywhere in the book. I tell them stay. Let's you and I sit down. Let's go through and see if this is you. You see what I'm saying?
If this room was filled today with people with terminal bone cancer or AIDS, and we all got together for this weekend, And somebody said, these two guys are coming who have a book. And in that book, there are precise directions on how to get free of your cancer. You and I would be running over each other to get to that book and follow those directions, because we have a deep and profound knowledge of the nature of our condition of bone cancer and how much time we have to live. Our willingness and how we pursue this program is in direct relation to the awareness we have of this first step and this part of the first step, that on our own, left to our own devices, without the power of God, I'm going to drink again. From 30 to 43, you're going to find some more stuff, and what you want to do is to continue to turn these statements into questions. On page 30, it says at the top, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholic. No person likes to think he is bodily. That was what we covered from the doctor's opinion to 23. And now, mentally different from his fellows. That's from 23 to 43. That's all we've been looking at, is why we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that my drinking career was characterized by countless vain attempts to prove I could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking. There's a great key there for some of you. Control and enjoy. Here's the question. When you could control it, did you enjoy it? And when you enjoyed it, were you able to control it? Is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion was astonishing in my life. I pursued it to the gates of insanity and death. I learned that I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, bodily, mentally, and spiritually. This is the first step in recovery. And I've heard people all over this fellowship say, first step doesn't have nothing to do with admitting you're alcoholic. It has to do with admitting you're powerless over alcohol, because of the way it's written in the short form on the wall and on page 59. Here it says, these people saw they had to fully concede to their innermost self, not up here in your head. The first step doesn't happen here by saying, I'm powerless over alcohol, because when I drink, I get in trouble and I end up places I don't like to end up. That's just a concession to your mind. They're saying we need to fully concede somewhere down in here, in my innermost self, at a gut level, that bodily I can't control the amount once I start. It has nothing to do with where it takes me or the drama. And mentally I can't keep myself stopped once I stop. And that has nothing to do with what... You see, the stuff out here that you and I have in our stories are not the things that connect us. And I believe you today are either interested like I am in the things that connect me to you, or you're interested in the things that separate me from you. And I tell you, I lived 30 years and a lot of time in this program consumed by the things that separate me from you, because that's what my ego wants, and it won. With the power of God, I become consumed with those things that join me to you, because that's what I seek, that's what I crave, that unity with you, not the separation from you. And I'll tell you this, except for maybe one or two guys in this room, there is very little in the drama in my story that connects me to you. The drama of my story would separate me from most of you, except a few. So what connects me to you? What connects me to a little 70-year-old woman from South Central Los Angeles who's not the same color, who's not the same sex, who never went to treatment, never got in trouble, never went to jail, barely ever left the house, and hardly ever gotten any kind of trouble? What connects me to her if it's all this drama that makes me an alcoholic? We don't have the same age. We don't have the same color. We don't have the same sex. I went to treatment 10 times. She never went. I went to jail and the penitentiary. She never went. I left the house a lot because when I drink, I got to move. When she drank, she couldn't move. She barely ever left the house and never got in trouble. What connects me to her? And we sat for 20 minutes and talked about everything from the doctor's opinion to the bottom of page 43 in this chapter, and all of a sudden we saw the amazing things that connect her and I together are the physical craving and all this stuff that happens once we start to drink. We lose control over the amount and this mental obsession that takes us back to the first drink. And all of a sudden she and I had a connection beyond race or age or sex or drama or emotion or where our drinking took us. I'm interested in the things today that connect every alky in this room.
And yet there's almost a movement going on to separate us. There's men's meetings and there's women's meetings and special interest meetings, and there's men's issues and there's women's issues, and maybe we only have one issue.
You've even heard it. There's as many ways to work the program as there are people in it. That separates every one of us and says that AA is a self-help program with an individual program for each of that enter it. And all of a sudden, not only do we not share a common problem hardly at all ever anymore, we no longer share a common solution. And they've won because they've got us all separated into as many different piles as you possibly can imagine. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. That means the delusion that I'm like other people with alcohol in my system or sober presently. Why do they say presently? Why do they say the delusion that I'm like other people presently has to be smashed? Because I'm not like other people right now here today sitting here 13 years sober. I am bodily and mentally and spiritually different from my fellows.
I go talk to any time I see anyone who's had a period of sobriety, any length of time relapse, and pick up a drink, I go talk to them. And that statement, presently, is what took every single one of them out. It starts real subtly, as they stop going to meetings. They don't have a home group anymore. They aren't working with anybody. They may or may not have done anything with the steps for a long time, and they're not doing prayer or meditation. And you know why all that happens? Because they are suffering from the delusion. They are no longer alcoholic, but they don't know they're suffering from that delusion.
Bottom of page 32, next to the last, 8 lines from the bottom. He fell victim to a belief that practically every alcoholic in this room has had, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man, he was fell to pieces and was dead within 4 years. This is a guy that stopped for 30 years. Most of us believe if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could therefore drink normally. Bottom of that paragraph. If you're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday you'll be immune to alcohol. Page 34.
For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is, how do I stop altogether? Huh, doesn't say one day at a time. That's interesting. We're assuming, of course, the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis will depend upon the extent to which they've already lost the power to choose whether they will drink or not drink.
See, I can't choose to stay sober and keep myself sober. I have no choice over that. I have to drink again on my own power. I also don't have the choice to drink again because of the power of God. I have no more choice to drink than I have to not drink. But all we have to do, we're going to look at it from both ends. We're going to look at choice as if it's a scale from a 0 to 100 and then from a 0 to 100. But first we got to look at this scale that starts off where sometime in your life you had the power of choice when you started to drink or before you ever took a drink. And somewhere during your drinking you crossed this 50% line, you crossed over that line where you had no more choice to not drink than the man in the moon. You just had to drink. All you have to do is reconcile that, and then we'll look at it at the other end of the work about this choice now that you're in the sunlight of the Spirit. But for now, just look back at your drinking and see if you reached this stage where there was no choice to not drink. You had to drink. There's also two tests on this page. You'll notice in the top paragraph there's a test. If you're not sure you're alcoholic, try to stay stopped for a year. That's to find out about the mind. Then you'll find a test at the bottom of the page where if you're not sure you're alcoholic, you can try some controlled drinking. No, that's not on this page, is it?
It's on page 31.
I'm sorry. Back on 31.
Bottom of it. Step over to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking.
That's the test for the body to see whether you get this craving or not. We've had people who have come to our group that have no more to lose than any of us, and they're early in their sobriety and they're not sure about this craving. And this process, over and over and over, from the doctor's opinion to 23, from 23 to 43, the process hasn't shown them. And they've been more committed to finding out truth than continuing to remain in a lie. And they've tried the test. Matter of fact, it was developed by the first woman alcoholic in AA, founder of the National Council on Alcoholism, and it's called the Marty Mann test. Marty Mann was the first woman in AA. She also founded the National Council on Alcoholism, and it was a test where you take two drinks a day for 30 days. And people that have come to our group to find out their own truth have taken that test, and some have passed and some have not. And they've been grateful for that because it's a helpful tool if this process doesn't work first. I'm betting my life that this process will show me more than my drinking did, so I don't ever have to drink again.
Top page 35 is again describing what we're looking at. We're going to describe the mental states. Remember, the main problem centers in your mind that will precede the relapse into drinking. I said this yesterday. The relapse ends after the first drink. It doesn't begin then. It ends then. So this is what we're looking at. The mental state that will precede the relapse into drinking, for this is the crux of the problem. What kind of thinking dominates an alcoholic who will repeat time after time the desperate experience in the first drink? Of what is he thinking? Now they give you an example of Jim. And if you look through Jim's story, I think about 6-8 lines up from the bottom, there's a real strong warning. All went well for a period of time, but Jim failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Book tells me over and over again the way I enlarge my spiritual life is help others. Page 36 in squiggly lines, they describe the alcoholic insanity. The thought crossed his mind, if he were to put an ounce of whiskey in his milk, it wouldn't hurt him on a full stomach. He ordered the whiskey, poured it into the milk. He vaguely sensed he wasn't being any too smart, but he felt reassured as he was taking the whiskey as a full stomach. Bottom of the page, Jim had a lot of knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, meaning he knew he couldn't control it. Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea he could take whiskey if he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this insanity. How can such a lack of proportion, the ability to think straight, be called anything else?
There's your definition for alcoholic insanity. Lack of proportion of the ability to think straight.
Consider this. If your experience abundantly confirms you're a real alcoholic and you're sitting in this room and you're telling people you got up this morning and you chose not to drink alcohol, consider you may be suffering from alcoholic insanity.
Could you say that again?
If your experience confirms you're a real alcoholic, that you have a craving of the body and an obsession of the mind, if you got up this morning or if you've been telling people or saying in meetings you get up in the morning and choose not to drink alcohol, I want you to consider that you're suffering from alcoholic insanity.
Therefore, the insanity of alcoholism is the idea that I have a choice. Thinking I have a choice is the insanity that this book is describing. Bottom of the page, there was no serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrible consequences might be. Here they are once again telling me about that day where there would be no thought at all. I don't know how many of you have talked to people that have gone back out after long periods of sobriety, but I have, and several of them found themselves in a bar or having picked up the first bottle and drank most of it before they realized what they were doing. Several of the stories that I've heard from older timers who drank again.
No,
our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that is an individual with a passion for jaywalking. This is the story. I didn't really get much from Jim or the guy who stayed sober for 35 years and then drank again, but I found my insanity in the story of the jaywalker.
Yeah.
And I just put in treatment for jaywalking and drinking.
So see, that's another example to make me look at my experience. I'm like Joe, I'm a jaywalker. Let me tell you why this is important to me. About 9 years sober, I wound up in a nut house. And, you know, when I went to treatment in 1982, I could look at my alcohol, and I could see quite clearly why I was in the nut house. When I'm 9 years sober and I've lost everything again, and I basically don't want to be alive on the planet, and the guy locks the door, and as he's doing that, he turns to me and he said, there's two things you need to know, Mark. One is you don't have a key, and two, we ain't letting you out till we tell you. I begin to have to ask myself, I think I missed a few things in here. I missed a whole bunch of things in here. Here's what I didn't truly understand. I am a jaywalker. I am an absolute chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and when I'm sitting in a meeting with 10 drunks, it doesn't matter to me anymore what they do. I know exactly what I got to do. I must continually work and rework the steps because it's my method of seeking a relationship with God. God is the only thing that gives me power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. I must belong to a home group. I must participate in that group, and I must sponsor a whole bunch of people. And I didn't understand that. Today, I'm glad I'm very, very clear on what I must do to treat my spiritual condition. I fell in the trap of thinking I could do what you do to treat my spiritual condition, and it damn near killed me sober. It almost killed me sober.
Top of page 39, four lines from the top, says the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. Now they're going to tell you about a guy named Fred. The bottom of the page, he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. In spite of his character and standing, Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. He was interested and conceded that some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. So if this is the admission the guy couldn't make that drank again, maybe I need to admit there's nothing I can do about this myself. Maybe that's an important admission. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge, key word there, knowledge, that he had acquired would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day he was back in the hospital.
Page 42. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that happened and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment I had an alcoholic mind. Look at this next sentence. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge could not help me in a strange mental blank spot. Now, I told you I had an experience with these pages this time through the work. Let me tell you what the experience was. We took moments of meditation in there, and here's what I did in a moment of meditation. I asked God to show me times in my sobriety I've been in a strange mental blank spot. He did. Many, many, many. And I was sitting there sober that morning, and I began to understand that sober many times I've been in a strange mental blank spot, and I was real clear on why I was sitting there sober that morning. And it had nothing to do with anything I thought I knew about staying sober. It had to do with His grace and His love and His spiritual defense that He was providing me. Go back into your experience in sobriety. Look at the times you're in incredible emotional pain. So turned inward. She left. You got fired. Who knows what it is? It's normally something outside yourself. And if you're like me, every tool available to you in this program is totally unavailable to you, and you're sitting here sober this morning. And there's a part of you that wants to claim credit for sitting here sober this morning. I had to get clear on who keeps me sober.
Back to the bottom of page 41. Eight lines from the bottom. Not only had I been off guard, I made no fight whatsoever against the first drink. This time, no thought of the consequences had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I had now remembered what my alcoholic friends told me and how they prophesized that if you have an alcoholic mind, the time and place will come that you will drink again.
Page 41, this is important because there's this thing in AA about I feel so terrible, therefore I might drink. The day Fred picked up a drink in page 41, here's what he says. Listen to this. He said, I'd been out of town before during this dry spell, so there's nothing new about that. Physically, he felt good. He had no pressing problems or worries, nothing to bring to a meeting. His business came off well. He was pleased. His partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day. There wasn't a cloud on the horizon, and he got drunk.
I hear people say, the bottom line to the first step for them is that they can't drink. You hear that all the time. The first step means I can't drink. That's as far away from the first step as you can possibly get. The first step means to me that on my own power, left to my own devices, I will drink. And they describe it right there. If I have an alcoholic mind, the time and place is going to come that I will drink again. Though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen. Bottom of the next paragraph. The process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. That's a great description of the first step. So turn that into a question. Remember, we're continuing to turn statements into questions. Has this process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that you can do the job yourself? That means without God. And then they'll finally, just like they did on the top of 23 with the craving, they're going to summarize the obsession. And they're going to say at the bottom of 43, and here's the summary, once more, at a certain time, you will have no effective mental defense against the first drink. Neither you nor any other human being will provide such a defense, except unless you're a rare case. Maybe there's a couple rare cases in this room today. Neither you nor any other human being is going to be able to provide that defense. Your defense must come from a higher power. So we're going to take a break now, but let's say two things. If you can, each in your own way, in the next 20 minutes, pause for 2 minutes and look at two pertinent considerations, we'll be ready to move on to the second half of step one, to the unmanageability. We've covered the body and the mind. Here's the two places that you can review. It'll take you 2 minutes. Top of 23, here's the question. Does your experience abundantly confirm that once you put alcohol into your system, something happens which makes it virtually impossible for you to stop? Condense the question. Can you control the amount once you start? Sit with that. Let it sit. Let it enter your deep, your innermost self. Does your experience abundantly confirm that? Can you control the amount once you start? Then sit with question number two. Can you keep yourself stopped? Must your defense come from a higher power? Will a day come? And I think here's the scary part to this bottom of 43. At a certain time, here's the question. Do you know what that certain time would look or feel like? See, there's the scary thing to that. At a certain time, and I don't know when that might be, there will be no effective mental defense against the first drink. Our friend Bob O from Denver always says, you better do the work because the day's going to come when you'll need it. My defense must come from a higher power. Sit with those two considerations. Can I control it once I start? And can I keep myself stopped now that I've stopped? Let's come back at 11 o'clock. We've covered the first half of step one, and we've covered from the title page up to the doctor's opinion. Since that, this morning, we've covered what happens after I take a drink, from the doctor's opinion to the top of 23, and what happens when I don't have any alcohol in my system at all and I go back to the first drink. We've covered the body and the mind, the physical craving and the mental obsession. Knowing who they were writing this to, and that things need to be repeated in lots of different ways, which was a principle that Bill used a lot. On page 44, you'll find that he repeats the same two pertinent points they've just spent 53 pages getting across. And I say 53 pages because we've covered about 10 pages in the doctor's opinion and 43 pages that were numbered. So in 53 pages, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. I would like to take that one step further and say I hope you've experienced your own alcoholism. They hope they've made clear the distinction between you and the non-alcoholic. And here's the two important points they've covered in 53 pages. When you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, which means stay stopped, which is about the mind. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, which is about the craving, you're probably alcoholic. Let's stop there for a second. I'm going to present you with a consideration. The people that wrote this book that we've had contact with, Mark and I, that were around back then, say that they put in several places what are called drunk traps. Knowing who they were writing this to, it's written by drunks, to drunks, for drunks. They put here in several places drunk traps. Probably, maybe, rarely. Different places where if you're looking for a way, so what do we mean by a drunk trap? Different places where if you're looking for a way out, they'll give it to you. Or if you're not sure and you have some doubt, they'll give you a place where you can explore that. So I'd like to read the text, and I'd like to ask you, what word do you think somebody you might be working with would go to who wasn't clear on either the craving or the obsession? One of the two they're not clear on. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, what would be the word somebody would go to and say, see, you don't have to have the craving and the obsession, you just have to have one or the other. What's the word they would focus on? Or. Well, that's not true. That's a drunk trap. Because here's the problem. Let's say you get the obsession, but you don't get the craving. Well, Next time you get the obsession, just drink the way you want. Or let's say you get the craving, but you don't get the obsession. Well, then make up your mind never to drink again, and that craving will never happen. See, it ain't or. To be powerless over alcohol, you got to have both. I also need to say this. I've never seen an alcoholic, and I've worked with hundreds. I've never seen an alcoholic that has one and not the other. But it's a great place if you're not clear. This statement, I believe, will show you what you need to go back to. If when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely, if you're not sure about that, go back over 23 to 43. So with that statement, when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely, mark 23 to 43, and that's where you need to go back if you're not sure about that. When drinking, you have little control over the amount. That's the doctor's opinion to 23. If you're not sure about that, go back to the doctor's opinion to 23. So I would say no one should go past this page unless they're sure that when they honestly want to, they can't quit entirely, and when drinking, they have little control over the amount. Now we're going to throw a consideration in that some people have to spend more time on than they did the craving or the obsession. And that is, if you turn it into a question, do you believe you're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer? I think once you're clear on the craving and the obsession, there's more on page 44 and 45 than any two pages we've covered so far. Let's look at the number of considerations that are on this page. I have seen guys and women have to spend more time on this last consideration than they did the craving or the obsession. And that is, do you really believe that you have an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer? Is there the right woman? Is there the right man? Is there the right amount of money? Is there the right job? Is there anything you can come up with other than a spiritual experience that's going to conquer your alcoholism?
And you can look at where you're right at day in terms of how long you've been sober. And if you've just been going to meetings and not working these steps and seeking God, then your experience is confirming you think you're suffering from an illness, and you don't have to have a spiritual experience. Let your experience show you where you're at with that. And here's what I want you to look at. If you've been doing that, like I did my first 3 years, you know why I did that? Because I had never found out my truth in step one. When I found out my truth in step one, I had to consider my God. There is nothing left for me but a spiritual experience. That took away any debate I was going to have with you about God, right? You see what I'm saying? So look at your experience right now today sitting in this room and ask yourself, because the program of recovery is outlined in the book, if you haven't been going through this book with someone, seeking this power through these steps, then maybe you're sitting here thinking you suffer from an illness and you don't need a spiritual experience to treat that illness.
Let's talk about the mechanics of this section. We'll call this section 4, and we'll call this the second half of step 1, and we'll call this the spirit. So we've taken the first step in 3 parts. Body, that's the physical craving. Mind, that's the mental obsession. That's the powerlessness, the first half of step 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, bodily and mentally. Dash, that our lives had become unmanageable spiritually. This is the spiritual malady. This is the second half of step 1. 2 things I'd like you to consider. This is actually a condition, a state of consciousness that takes place before you ever drank, when alcohol wasn't working, and further away from your last drink than you've ever been, sober. This is a state of consciousness that exists except when spirits poured on it work. This is the stuff you pour booze on to make it go away. So there's 3 terms I'd like you to write down, and the 3 terms are unmanageability, spiritual malady, and untreated alcoholism. And here's the question I'd like you to ask yourself. Are these 3 separate terms, or are they terms that describe the same thing? Are these terms synonymous, or are these terms separate? And here's what I'd like to present to you. I believe these 3 terms describe the same thing. I believe they're synonymous. I believe the unmanageability is the spiritual malady, and I believe the spiritual malady is untreated alcoholism, and vice versa. I'd also like you to consider another question. Is this condition internal or external? Because here's what I'd like you all to get free of. The unmanageability of your life is not outside of you, in circumstance or emotion. The unmanageability is a deeper state of consciousness that transcends circumstance or emotion. It is a malady of the human spirit, beyond body, mind, or emotion. For example, you ever had all your ducks in a row and your life on the outside was almost perfect and you were still screwed inside? There was an emptiness. Have you ever been in a large crowd and felt terribly alone? Have you ever had everything out here just the way you'd like it and had an emptiness inside? And have you ever been emotionally at peace with still an emptiness underneath it? It's my contention that this part of the first step, as we just did with the other two parts of the first step, this part of the first step also has nothing to do with the outside circumstance or your emotional state. I would like you to use three pages. All of page 44, half of page 45, up to lack of power is our dilemma, and only the middle paragraph on page 52. I would like you to continue to turn statements into questions. And when we get to page 52, the middle paragraph, we're going to begin to talk about three ways of looking at page 52, which describes the unmanageability, the spiritual malady, and untreated alcoholism.
Let's continue. It says, to one who feels he is an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience, spiritual experience, may seem impossible. But to continue as he is will mean disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And the book's already discussed to us what the hopeless variety is, craving of the body, obsession of the mind. To be doomed to an alcoholic death, step one, or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. And I talked about this yesterday. Here's why they're not easy to face. Those of us in this room are unsuccessful dying an alcoholic death. We don't even have the power to do that. And we also don't have the power to live on a spiritual basis of life, which is why they are not easy alternatives to face. But then it goes on to say, and it's not so difficult. Half our original fellowship were that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not a true alcoholic. But after a while, we had to face the fact we must find a spiritual basis of life or else.
Or else what?
Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. Cheer up, something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. But our experience shows you need not be disconcerted. Book's trying to say, you can be sitting in here. It was brought up yesterday. No idea of God when I was raised. I'm struggling with God. Book says, doesn't make any difference. You can be a full-blown atheist. You can be an agnostic. Don't worry about it. Just take the action. Don't worry about it. Goes on to say, the mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, Mark would have recovered long ago. But Mark found such codes and philosophies did not save Mark, no matter how much Mark tried. Highlight that. Mark could wish to be moral. Mark could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, Mark could will these things with all his might, but the needed power was not there. Mark's human resources, as marshaled by Mark's will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. So I go back into my experience and say, is this true? Is this true? Lack of power, that was Mark's dilemma. Is this my truth? Based on my experience, Mark has to find a power by which he could live, and it's got to be a power greater than Mark. Obviously, well, where and how is Mark to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. The main object of this book is to enable Mark to find a power greater than Mark, which will solve Mark's problem. Mark doesn't solve Mark's problem. He goes in search of a power to solve his problem, and this power will show him how to live.
That's an interesting statement. How many of us have turned this program into a program where enabled us to find a power greater than ourselves so we could solve our problems? It doesn't say that. It says the main object of this is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. The power solves my problems, not me. I don't acquire a problem. I don't acquire power so I can solve my problems. Let's go back to the top of 44 again. And look at the number of considerations that have to do with powerlessness and unmanageability that we didn't touch in the first 53 pages. First, they start with the two that we did touch, and that is when you honestly want to, you can't stay quit. You can't stay stopped because of your mind. And when drinking, you have little control over the amount. which is about your body. Those are the two that I've conceded to in the previous 53 pages. But now let's look at how much deeper it goes. When I honestly want to, I can't quit entirely, and when drinking, I have little control over the amount. But now I have an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer, and having faced that, I only have two alternatives: to die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis, and I can't pull either one of those off. Isn't that really pretty powerless when you can't pull off the only two choices that you have left? And what do I mean by that? No one in this room has been successful at dying an alcoholic death. We're not the ones that are successful. This room is not filled with success stories of those that are able to die an alcoholic death. They're the ones that aren't here. They're dead. So we're failures at dying. Also, the other alternative is to live life on a spiritual basis. We're also the failures at that. Because if everyone in this room could self-will their own spiritual growth, we'd all be doing a lot better than we are at this point. Several of us would have led a group of you off to Israel or someplace by now, right? So my only... Yeah, Jonestown. Hawktown, right? Joeytown. Right? My only two alternatives, I can't pull off either one. That's why they're not easy to face. We're failures at living, we're failures at dying. Now we go to a deeper level. Having chosen to live life on a spiritual basis, they say, or else, now having chosen to live life on a spiritual basis, which I think everyone in this room has chosen to one degree or another, having chosen that, I can't even pull that off. Because if living life on a spiritual basis or a better code of morals or a better philosophy of life or making things go the way I would like were possible, I would have recovered long ago. I can't will these things with all my might. And what you're going to notice in different meetings is that people have gotten off different floors of the first step. And I'd like to say that you go down before you go up. And there's about five levels to the first step going down before you're catapulted up to the second step, and that door to the second step opens up. And here's how it goes down. Some people will say, I have a physical craving for alcohol. Some people won't even acknowledge that. They'll just say, hey, I got a problem with low self-esteem. I need to keep myself sober and just not drink and work on myself. Not only are they not powerless over alcohol, but their lives are manageable. And they didn't even go down to the mezzanine. They didn't even go down to the first floor going down. Some people will then concede to, well, I got a physical craving, but I just don't drink no matter what. And they went down one floor, but they got off on seeing the physical craving. They got off the elevator. It goes no deeper than that for them because they can keep themselves sober. Then some people will say, I have a physical craving for alcohol and a mental obsession, but now that I know that, I can keep myself sober. And they went two levels down, but now they can keep themselves sober and they got off the elevator. Then some will say, I have a physical craving for alcohol and a mental obsession which confines me to drink again, and in and of myself, on my own power, I'll drink again. But I can make this spiritual experience happen the way I'd like it to. And they talk about surrender like it's something they can make happen. All I need to do is surrender so I never drink again because I have a physical craving and a mental obsession which confines me to drink again. They got off on like the third floor. And now it's going down the page. It's going down the elevator. Now they'll say, I have a physical craving for alcohol. I have a mental obsession which confines me to drink again. And what I need, because I only have two alternatives, to die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis, is to live life on a spiritual basis. And I can't even make that happen because lack of power is my dilemma. And they've seen the entire first step. Then you think you've done well in admitting all of that. Because, see, they get to our real problem, whether it's bodily, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually, whether it's keeping myself sober now that I've stopped, controlling it once I start, making a spiritual experience that I desperately need happen, or managing each area of my life, what's my real problem? Lack of power. This is a condition, and you can mark that, and you can circle it, and you can underline it, and you can put parentheses and exclamation points. That is a condition of body, mind, emotion, and spirit that a lot of people do not want to admit even exists, that it's even possible. It is a state of consciousness, lack of power. Bodily, I can't control booze once it's in my system. Mentally, I can't keep myself stopped from that first drink. Emotionally, I can't control my emotions. And spiritually, I cannot make the very experience I need, the only thing that's going to save me, happen on my own power. because lack of power is my dilemma. Then you think you've done well in admitting all that. You've gone all the way down to the bottom of the first step, and they say, now that we've got you down here and you see that in each of these areas, bodily, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, lack of power is my dilemma, they're now, we're going to go to the middle of page 52, and they're going to take you through every area of your life.
Make a quick note where the book says where and how are we to find this power. Write page 55 in there. Now let's go to page
55. Where and how? Where
and how are we to find the power? If lack of power is our dilemma, and the book says it's going to tell us where and how,
and that's obvious to you,
then I'm trying to point out to you where it's going to tell you you're going to find the power and how you're going to find the power. I think it's important to know that if lack of power. It's on page 55. It's where it's going to tell us. Now let's go to
page. We'll get to that in the second. In the second step, they will answer their own question. From 40.
Where and how? Yeah.
On page 45. She means where's the question? 45, not 55. The paragraph starts off, lack of power is our dilemma, but we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than myself. Obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? They'll answer that when we get to the end of step two.
Now,
let's go to
page 52. Middle paragraph. Now, as we read this, I want you to consider some things Joe talked about. Here's what I want you to consider. This paragraph is going to describe unmanageability, and what we all need to consider is that it is an internal condition, and nothing external will ever treat it. Nothing external will ever treat it. Money won't treat it. The right man or woman won't treat it. The right job won't treat it. The right house won't treat it. Living in the right state. I mean, we were just kidding Susie about this yesterday. She still has some old ideas about what's going to treat this. You see? That's a continual journey, stripping away old ideas about what you think is going to treat this. So now let's see what it says. Mark has to ask himself why he shouldn't apply to his human problems this same race to change his point of view.
As he takes us through this the first time, let's look at let's look at this paragraph in relationship to you on your own power. So before each time he takes us through an area of our life, he'll say, on my own power, can I?
Okay. So on my own power, am I having trouble with personal relationships?
On my own power, can I make personal relationships go the way I want them to?
On my own power, can I control my emotional nature? On my own power, am I a prey to misery and depression? On my own power, do I have a hard time making a living? On my own power, do I have a feeling of uselessness? On my own power, am I full of fear? On my own power, am I unhappy? On my own power, can I help other people?
Now, I get to face, but I don't think anybody in this room is operating on their own power anymore, or we wouldn't be here this morning. So, but before we get to that, let's bring it back to booze. And the second time through, let's look at if every area of your life was exactly the way you wanted it, would that be enough to keep you sober? So let's look at the times where you had all your ducks in a row. Relationship was going pretty good. You got some power over your emotional nature. Misery and depression aren't really that bad. You're making a living. You're being of help to other people. You're not full of fear. You're not feeling useless. So here's the question. If your life was manageable, would that be enough to keep you sober? And it'll bring you right back to booze, and you'll see even the times. I'll give you an example. When I left the Michigan State Penitentiary, I had a dream. It was a little unrealistic, but it came true. And my dream was I wanted to deal blackjack in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a car, a penthouse, clothes, a woman, and jewelry. And a year and a half after I got out of the penitentiary, through some circumstances and where I was taken, I was dealing blackjack at the Dunes Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a penthouse, car, clothes, and a woman, and some jewelry. And I couldn't keep myself sober. So with a manageable life, could I keep myself sober? Now, the third way, he'll take us through one more time, and let's approach it from this angle. This is where we all are now today. See, I got to make all three parts of the first step current, or they'll only be fond memories. Here's what I mean. If looking at the craving is only in the past during those 10 or 15 or 20 years that you drank, then all you've done is see the craving in the past. You must bring the craving into the present by answering this question. Do you believe that craving would happen to you today if you were to take a drink? Then we started looking at the obsession, and I don't want it to just be a fond memory of what used to happen 13, 20, 50, 20 years ago when I drank. I want it to be, do I believe that obsession could happen today? Now with the unmanageability, and here's the one that kills me, and I don't like to say this, but here's the way to look at the middle paragraph on 52 to experience the unmanageability currently in your life today. Here's the way to approach it. With the power and grace of God that I've been given up to today, what do I do with each area of my life with power? So with the power of God, what do I do with personal relationships? Over any considerable period of time, I run them into the ground.
And
with God.
And consider the relationship with yourself, not just outside yourself. What kind of personal relationship are you having with yourself today?
It's better, but herein lies one of my main reasons for doing the work on a regular basis. My ego, and if you want to read the doctor, because there's always a doctor involved in this first step stuff and why do the work again. Silkworth gave us the craving. Carl Jung gave us the obsession. And if you want to read the doctor that knew more about why you need to do this work on a regular basis is Dr. Harry Thibault, who wrote a lot of stuff in our history books other than in this book. And it also, if you have a way to order Hazleton material, which I'm sure Glenn knows about. just kidding. Hazleton puts out a great four or five pamphlets. It's a Harry Thibault packet. One of the best ones is Ego Reduction and Surrender, or something like that. And he talks about why you and I need to do this work on a regular. I'm talking 1 through 9, because as you can tell already, one of the big myths in Alcoholics Anonymous around this country is you work the first 9 steps once, and you practice 10 and 11 and 12 for the rest of your life. And I'd like to ask those people that believe that. Number one, I'm beginning to wonder if they've ever done 1 through 9. Because anybody I've ever met that's done 1 through 9 and had that dramatic change in their life, internally and externally, why wouldn't you want to do it again when your life gets a little flat? So I'm beginning to wonder, kind of like I'd like to meet the guy that first said, and I'd like to take him and I'd like to strangle him really slow, the guy that first said, we just don't drink no matter what. Because where I live, they alienate alcoholics like me when they say, we just don't drink no matter what. I'd also like to meet the guy who started, work the first 9 steps once and live your life in 10, 11, and 12. Because you know what they're saying? Practice these principles. They're saying the 12th step says we practice the first 9 principles once and lived in the last 3 for the rest of our life. And I'd also like to ask the people that believe that, where in any of the AA literature that they've ever read did any of our founders ever write, you practice the first 9 steps once? I think it's also the main difference between Bill and Bob's experience. As effective as Bill Wilson was, and we all know he was very effective with alcoholics, running that office, I mean, he's one of the founders of AA. The man had 16 years of major depression and did some stuff you don't even want to tell new people about. You're sorry that it's even in Pass It On. I mean, the guy did LSD for 3 years with Father Ed Dowling before it was classified to enhance the spiritual experience. Niacin, Ouija boards, weird stuff, dying of untreated alcoholism because he would not submit himself to what saved his life the first time he went through it. Dr. Bob, on the other hand, because of Harry Thibault, who was a major influence on his life, continued to work and rework the first 9 steps on a like our great grand sponsor in Chicago, Paul Martin, written extensive articles for the Grapevine. Mark, anybody that's interested in those, Mark can help you get some of the, and Rick from Chicago could probably get you in touch with Paul if you want some of the articles he's written for the Grapevine over the years on why you continue to practice these principles. But herein lies one of my reasons. Not only because I'm still powerless over alcohol and I need this power to stay sober, but because of what my ego does with power over any considerable period of time. Now, personal relationships are better in my life today than they ever have been, and they always are each time I go through the work. But after about a year, I start to experience this tension, and this relationship really isn't going the way that I want it to. The intent that I had in my heart and my emotional nature, I start to get a little edge, and misery and depression start to creep in, and I start to get this little tension with some of my friends going on where I live, and I get a little fear going on, and I can't seem to be as effective as I was 6 months ago when I just blasted through the first 9 steps again and was in 10, 11, and 12. And I'm starting to experience some fear, and my happiness starts to change. And intuitively, I know it's time for me to start the work again. And I get to face what I do with power in relationship to page 52.
So you take yourself today, bring this current. Remember, we talked about the trap of when I came in and when I came in and when I came in. It's like our bodies are not living off the food we ate last week. So as I read it this time, look at your life. Bring yourself current right now today, regardless of how long you've been sober, and ask yourself this question. With the power and grace that God has given me up to this point in time, how am I having trouble in personal relationships? You want to have a fun exercise. You take a piece of paper and you take each one of these areas and ask God to show you, and you start with yourself. And then you go all around you and take a look. How am I doing in personal relationships today with everybody in my life? Where am I at with controlling my emotional nature today? How many of us in this room have had this said to us? You get angry over such a little thing. How am I doing today with misery and depression? How am I doing today with making a living? Now, making a living is not just money. Am I a good steward? Making a living, making a life. Can I enjoy the day? I'm always amazed about people's lives who are totally dictated by the weather. How are you doing today? Well, it's rainy. It's hot. It's cold. I hear. I don't even ask people that anymore. I mean, you know, I wake up, my breath is coming in. Wow, what a great day. You think I care what the weather is? I mean, God handles that part. I'm grateful for anything, but you see what I'm saying? So again, how am I doing today about a feeling of uselessness? Feeling of uselessness. How am I doing right now today without being full of fear? Let's go back in the last week. How many times were you in situations and experienced a bunch of fear? How am I doing today with helping others? How am I doing today with being happy or unhappy? To get current with what have I done, that part of me. The book says that we're self-will run riot, though we don't think so. What has my ego done with the power and grace that God has given me up to right now this morning at 11:34, sitting here in Battle Creek, Michigan? Do I think that maybe if I'm willing to submit to this work again, that God can take me into dimensions that I've never experienced before? Do I think that that is possible? But I wouldn't make that decision to do that unless I get current and honest with myself about how am I doing today? I mean, for every person in here in your personal relationships, if you think this is the best that they're going to be, then God is not everything. He's finite and he's limited. My experience is much different than that. My experience is my relationships today as a result of going through the steps this year are at a level with men and women that I couldn't even have dreamed up a year ago. You see what I'm saying?
You're also going to find that the important stuff you need to admit in step two comes from your honest admission about each area of your life when you look at the unmanageability. Let's take a moment and do a little guided meditation and wrap up the first step, and then we're going to stop for a minute, and let's just try and be silent for a moment. Does my experience abundantly confirm that once I put alcohol in my system, something happens which makes it virtually impossible for me to stop? Do I lose control over the amount once I start to drink? Am I convinced that at a certain time there will be no effective mental defense against the first drink, and that neither me nor any other human being will be able to provide that defense? Must my defense come from a higher power? Can I keep myself stopped now that I've stopped? So am I convinced that when I honestly want to, I can't stay stopped? And when drinking, I have little control over the amount? And am I also convinced that I have an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer? Having faced that, do I believe I have any other alternatives but to die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis? And having chosen to live life on a spiritual basis, can I make that happen on my own power? Can I will that with all my might? Or is the needed power not there? So bodily, whether we're talking about the craving, or mentally, whether we're talking about the obsession, or spiritually, whether we're talking about me staying sober and living life on a spiritual basis, or emotionally, when we're talking about being able to control my emotional nature, is lack of power my dilemma? When taken to each area of my life, am I having trouble with personal relationships on my own power? Can I control my emotional nature? Can I make misery and depression go away on my own power? Can I make a living that's satisfactory to me on my own power? Can I make uselessness, the feeling of uselessness, go away on my own? Can I make fear disappear? And can I, on my own power, make myself happy? And can I, on my own power, make myself of real help to other people?